This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Cleaner but perhaps more expensive gasoline is in the offing. We'll tell you about that. The perils of pursuing your dream job on the broadcast today as well. Also, My Little Pony, like you've never really thought of them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 29th of March. Good, as always, to have you with us. And listen, on a Friday at the end of what has honestly been something of a brutal week, go ahead and take a deep breath. And now imagine that that nice cleansing moment you just had could get even nicer. The EPA announced today it wants to cut the amount of sulfur in gasoline by 60%, 60%. Figures that would reduce pollution enough to save as many as 2,400 lives a year, prevent a whole bunch of respiratory diseases in children as well. Of course, getting there is going to have some costs. The American Petroleum Institute, Big Oil's lobbying group, says it would add 9 cents to the price of every single gallon of gas you buy. The EPA, don't you know, has its own estimate, less than a penny a gallon. Marketplace's David Weinberg starts us off today explaining that predicting the price of gas can be really complicated.
Rick Flagan is a professor of chemical engineering at Caltech in Pasadena. In front of his office, he has a beautiful view of the mountains a few miles away.
When I first came here, there were months when you could not see the mountains. It's a dramatic change.
Flagan says what changed was emissions from power plants that burned high sulfur fuels. Eventually, those plants switched to fuels with less sulfur, which improved air quality significantly. The EPA wants to follow a similar path and reduce sulfur emissions in gasoline by two-thirds. The American Petroleum Institute estimates the cost of producing cleaner fuel is 10 times what the EPA estimates.
I know there's a sense out there that the industry is probably crying wolf. And I would say they're kind of crying a wolf puppy.
Tom Close is a chief oil analyst with Gas Buddy.
At any moment, that puppy can turn into a wolf if the right conditions prevail. And we really have no way of knowing what sort of conditions are going to be around in 2017.
Close says it's nearly impossible to predict the price of gas that far into the future. And if the cost of cleaner gas does add 10 cents to the price, it doesn't necessarily mean people will pay more at the pump. It could spur changes in people's driving habits. They might drive less or buy a more fuel-efficient car. But even that isn't always a given.
One might think that after the most expensive year on record, people would move down to more efficient vehicles, but they haven't.
The top two selling vehicles of 2012 were both full-size pickups. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
In Manhattan today, that rarest of sights, a financier being led away from his Park Avenue home in handcuffs. Michael Steinberg pleaded not guilty to charges of insider trading at his arraignment this afternoon, but the spectacle does turn up the heat on his employer, SAC Capital Advisors, one of this country's biggest hedge funds. Just a couple of weeks ago, SAC paid $600 million, a little bit more, actually, to make separate allegations of insider trading go away. And all the while, the hedge fund's owner, Stephen A. Cohen, hence SAC, has been making headlines with a different kind of spending. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith looks back at Cohen's week that was.
Stephen Cohen just paid a cool $155 million for a Picasso painting. Then news broke that he's also just snapped up a $60 million beachfront home in the Hamptons.
Certainly a big week for Steve Cohen and SAC Capital. Not a good big week.
Max Wolf is a senior economist at Greencrest Capital. He points out all of this personal spending is happening at a time when SAC employees are getting arrested and the hedge fund is settling insider trading allegations to avoid potentially higher fines in court. Wolf believes it's no coincidence.
So keeping SAC open and keeping up with the conspicuous consumption for which Steve Cohen is deservedly famous is part of sending a strong signal that it's business as usual, that he is still there, that SAC Capital is still there.
Cohen's hedge fund has been under pressure for 6 months as insider trading allegations mounted. Investors have pulled almost $2 billion out of SAC Capital. The company still manages about $15 billion, but the scrutiny could cause more investors to flee. James Cox is a professor of securities law at Duke.
It's a rare situation where an individual can be charged with essentially with insider trading, which is broadly seen as cheating, and be able to maintain a kind of professional credibility.
Cohen hasn't been accused directly of wrongdoing, and he maintains all of his trades were legal. Still, some see this moment as a turning point.
It almost feels like we're coming to the end of an era.
That's Marian Maniker, and he's talking about Cohen's art collection. Maniker says Cohen blazed a trail for financiers collecting art, and the Picasso purchase is right in his wheelhouse.
He really isn't doing anything he hasn't done before. It feels like he's coming back to a place where he was in 2007.
Sounds a little bit like the stock market, and some think it's ready for a fall, too. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Speaking of the stock market, on Wall Street today, nothing doing. They had the day off for Good Friday, but we'll think of something to say all the same when we do the numbers. Without further ado, 4 or so minutes of live radio to find out what the heck happened since Monday. For that, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon from Reuters. They are both in our studios in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Felix, let me start with you, I guess, just because, I don't know, I feel like it. Let us touch glancingly on SAC. They're paying $600 million to $600 million, rather, to make the charges go away. Are they sort of buying off regulators, really?
Absolutely. They're paying $600 million in order to get off scot-free without having to admit to doing any wrong. It's kind of weird. What company – and remember, this is very much Stevie Cohen's own personal money.
Stevie? You call him Stevie?
Stevie. Me and Stevie, we're like
okay.
that. He is his money, and he's paying this money so that he gets to avoid having to admit that he did anything wrong. But why would you pay $600 million if you did nothing wrong?
Well, because you got billions and billions and billions, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's not going to crimp his style, as we've seen.
All right. Lee, let us turn now to the global economic story du jour, du week, de semaine, if you will, the past 10 days. Cyprus. Paul Krugman in the New York Times came out the other day and said, you know what? Throw him out. It's time for him to go. What do you think?
Well,
get him out of the EU.
Well, the euro. They can still be in the EU.
All right. Well, let us not split hairs. But Lee, go ahead.
That's what people said about Greece, too. I mean, there is, you know, this question is going to come up again and again the more these crises start happening. And it does prove, you know, the euro way back when it was planned, you know, you can't really we're finding out that maybe you can't have fiscal unity without political unity. And is this going to be the start of more crises like this? I mean, Cyprus is its own situation for many reasons, but it's definitely worth, I think, the panic that has spread throughout Europe for the precedents that it's setting.
I was talking to a guy the other day, Felix, who said Luxembourg is perhaps the next country to imperil the euro, to which I can only say, come on, Luxembourg?
There's any number. I mean, Latvia is going to join, and as soon as it joins, it's going to be this offshore bank.
Why would you join the eurozone right now?
Well, it's a really good question. If I was the Cypriot, I would be very tempted to leave the euro because look at the capital controls they've got on.
Yeah.
They've already, in point of fact, left. A Cypriot euro is not worth the same as a euro in Spain or Germany or Luxembourg. So if you're going to do it right. Devalue, become more competitive, you know?
Yeah. Hey, Lee, let me ask you the make me care question. If I am, he says flippantly, if I am going about my merry way in Sheboygan or Ottumwa or Albuquerque, New Mexico, make this story matter to me.
Well, you bring up a good point. It's a very small country. It has a population the size of Vermont. But the important thing is, I guess a couple things. One is that you know there's precedents happening there. It's never been suggested that you tax depositors' bank accounts ever. Mm. It's also never really been – it's never happened that they can't access all of their funds as they can't this week and for the next month. So that's scary, and the notion that that could happen elsewhere in Europe is significant. And then you also have to think about any international company that is doing business in Cyprus. Granted, maybe that's not a whole lot of companies, but they weren't able to access their capital at all for that week, and that's going to you know really dissuade international companies from doing business in Cyprus for sure, but maybe they're going to think twice about other places.
But the big reason to care, Kai, is that if Cyprus leaves the euro, that proves that it is possible for a country to leave the euro. And if it is possible for a country to leave the euro, then that's very bad news for Portugal, for Ireland, for Spain, for Italy, because people are going to worry that, you know, if something is possible, then at some point it's bound to happen.
All kidding aside, are you substantively worried, Felix, about what Cyprus means for the euro and thus the rest of us? Quickly.
Yes, I actually am. I think that Cyprus is the beginning of a whole new chapter in the European crisis where we're not getting bailouts anymore, where countries are being left to their own devices. And if you're not getting bailed out and if you are getting left to your own devices, then that means a breakup of the eurozone.
Lee, quickly, same question to you. Are you really worried?
I mean, I think it's more of a special situation. Yeah. I was more worried when, for example, Spain was teetering so badly last year. But you know, Felix brings up some good points, as he always does.
Oh, there you go. All right. We'll see you guys later. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon from Reuters. See you guys.
Thanks,
have a good weekend.
Okay.
Bye-bye now. There was a picture that was all over the place a couple of months ago of a cop in New York City giving a pair of boots to a guy who was panhandling barefoot on a cold night in Manhattan. That picture became kind of a symbol of simple acts of kindness, but it also put that guy, Jeffrey Hillman is his name, into the national spotlight, first with the news that he wasn't actually homeless, and then this week with headlines that he owns 30 pair of shoes. So now from the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark tries to figure out why all the fascination with Mr. Hillman.
Jeffrey Hillman's accidental fame has gone on a lot longer than 15 minutes. Here's just a couple of the news reports from the last few days.
Jeffrey Hillman, the homeless New York City man given a $100 pair of boots by a concerned police officer, apparently didn't need them.
His name was Jeffrey Hillman. We tracked him down at his apartment in the Bronx.
I can't even begin to tell you. He is so scared right now.
John Graff grew up with Hillman. They'd lost touch after high school graduation when Hillman joined the Army. More than 30 years later, last December, Graff read one of the first stories about the barefoot homeless man and recognized his old friend. Graff is helping Hillman now with his utility bills and rent on his subsidized apartment.
It's really, really taken him back from what recovery we have started to make. With all of this CBS and NBC and everybody coming to his door with cameras.
The cameras arrived this week after a New York Post reporter spotted Hillman at the end of a day of panhandling. He was, quote, counting a huge wad of bills with the dexterity of a bank teller. At least that news story is the immediate reason for the media frenzy. But Michael Katz, author of the book The Undeserving Poor, says there's a deeper reason, one that has been around as long as there have been people in need.
Well, we can't help everybody who asks. We never have enough resources for that. So, in fact, we have to draw lines, as difficult as drawing those lines may be.
And the lines are often drawn, Katz says,
between the deserving, the undeserving, the worthy, and the unworthy.
But the problem, he says, is that when you get down to an individual life,
you begin to find that the distinction melts away.
As in the case of Jeffrey Hillman. He's not perfect. He has a history of drug use and a rap sheet of a few crimes. But his friend John Graff points out,
he served this country. He's got a mental illness.
So is he deserving? Undeserving? For Graff, he's a friend in need. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
On Monday next, a bunch of grown men are going to swing by their local Build-A-Bear retailer and build their very own My Little Pony. Hasbro, the company that owns the My Little Pony franchise, is launching their own Build-A-Pony enterprise. And it turns out some of the biggest fans of those pastel playthings are grown-ups, as I said. They are known as bronies. So we have called Jim Silver. He's the editor of the website TimeToPlayMag.com to help explain things to me. Jim, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
I have to confess, Mr. Silver, that when my producers first said we were going to do this interview, I thought they were pranking me. You have to tell me what a brony is.
Brony is a fan of the TV show My Little Pony. I actually went to the first BronyCon convention.
Wait, they have BronyCon?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
And it is a wild experience. The first time I went there, it was in a hotel across from Penn Station, and the line was out the door. And this is men generally 18 to about 40 years old who are fans of the show My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic. And you will see them dressed up as their favorite ponies, whether it be Rainbow Dash or Big Mac. And you also have to know the correct terms. There are some women there, not too many. They're Pegasisters.
So what is it? Is it a nostalgia thing? Is it being in the club? I mean, I don't know.
Well, when talking to many of them, it's all about the values of the show. They fell in love with the show, and they know everything about My Little Pony. They know the voices. They know the artists. It's an unbelievable club, so to speak. And it just keeps growing.
So these bronies and Pegasisters, I guess, how important are they to the Hasbro franchise, to the My Little Pony franchise?
Well, Hasbro does not market to the bronies. Yeah. I mean, the volume of toys that they buy and merchandise, it does help their overall volume. I mean, these fans are collectors, so they go out and buy the toys, they buy the T-shirts, and they buy all the other licensed merchandise. You're talking about a $100 million-plus brand wholesale to Hasbro. It is one of the top shows on their TV network, The Hub. So you could probably say it's, if not the most important girls brand, one of the most important girls brands to Hasbro.
I should tell you, so Pinkie Pie and Rainbow Dash, which is in the latest announcement from Hasbro, they cost $24 a whack, man.
That's right. Well, it's the opportunity to go to Build-A-Bear instead of making a bear, making your own pony. And that's going to attract a lot of girls. And as we heard from the bronies, it's going to attract a lot of bronies there.
Mom's going to hold the little girl a little closer, tighter, huh?
Yeah, it's going to make for an awkward experience when they come in.
Jim Silver, he's a toy analyst. He runs the website timetoplaymag.com. Jim, thanks a lot.
Good talking to you.
Coming up, setting up yourself on your dream job gets really expensive really fast.
We carried the very basic, for example, Oscar de la Renta, like the opening minimum buy we had. And that opening minimum buy was at least about $30,000.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, no, fooled you. Markets in the U.S. and most of Europe were closed today for the holiday, so we're not going to do things as usual. Instead, the quarter that just ended. How about that? The Dow Industrials and the S&P 500, as you know, are in record territory. The Dow up more than 11% for the first 3 months of this year. The S&P 500 has gained an even 10%. Hewlett-Packard takes the cake for the quarter's most improved blue chip, up 67%. Some companies that are only too glad to kiss Q1 goodbye. Caterpillar off nearly 3% for the 3 months. Alcoa, the only other blue chip to end in the hole, reversed nearly 2%. We'll be back on Monday for the start of the second quarter. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday, April Fool's Day. The Commerce Department reports on construction spending for February. 35,000 people are expected at the White House for the annual Easter egg roll. The tradition turns 135. And on April 1st, 1970, President Nixon signed legislation that bans cigarette commercials from running on TV and radio. It took effect the following year. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so here comes a story that rolls immigration policy in with corporate financing. Congress, as you've heard, is about to get itself hip deep into immigration reform, focused, if one might hazard a guess, on low-skilled workers, agriculture mostly, and highly skilled workers in high tech. Not quite so often talked about are the rich workers. The government's been issuing a growing number of what are officially designated as EB-5 visas, sometimes called investor visas. They let would-be immigrants who've got $500,000 or more to spare and who can invest it to create or save 10 jobs get a green card. Adam Allington reports now from St. Louis.
Meet EB-5 visa holder.
My name is Renhao Zhen. I go by Philip.
Zheng is a finance major at UCLA and one of about 1,500 foreign nationals who got an EB-5 visa in 2011. He got it because his dad, a wealthy Chinese businessman in the precious metals industry, was able to plunk down a $500,000 investment in Brooklyn's new Barclays Center, home of the Brooklyn Nets.
In an investment, there is always risk, but that risk is pretty minimum because we know that the Nets has been a really good team.
The catch is that in exchange for visas, the Zheng's investment must satisfy a government review that it created or saved 10 American jobs. Last year, the number of EB-5 visa holders grew to 3,600. This year, it's predicted to be closer to 10,000. Recipients are mostly businessmen and entrepreneurs. Zheng says those are exactly the kind of people the United States needs to revive its tepid economy.
From an American point of view, I think it's a good policy because think about it. You have to put $500,000 away for 5 years. I mean, your family has to be in like a really good standing in the society.
So people like Zheng get a U.S. visa, businesses can access capital, projects get launched, jobs are created. What's not to like?
Well, the first concern is that we shouldn't be selling U.S. citizenship because that's what we're doing. Secondly, if we are going to sell U.S. citizenship, let's at least charge more for it.
Mark Kerkorian is the director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a D.C. think tank which favors tighter immigration controls.
That's ridiculous. I mean, that's banana republic level of policy.
Kerkorian says if we're going to be selling green cards, the cost should be more like $10 million, and it should go directly to the Treasury, not developers. But cities across the country don't necessarily see it that way. Over the past couple years, publicly funded economic development offices have opened in communities specifically to attract foreign investment to local projects. And the carrot...
Well, the visa is everything. The visa is the carrot.
Mark Nowak heads up the Gateway to the Midwest Investment Center, which opened this week in St. Louis. Nowak says the EB-5 program has filled the void left behind by tighter lending standards at banks. On top of that, the interest rates paid to EB-5 investors is often much lower than what banks charge.
So the project wins because it's cheaper money. The investor wins because their ultimate return is their permanent residency here in the United States.
Since it was established 20 years ago, federal officials say the EB-5 program has attracted about $2.2 billion in investment. But that's less than 1% of the total pool of direct foreign investment in the U.S. today. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Have you ever popped into a small business, say a small boutique that sells really nice clothes for women or for men, or maybe high-end stuff for your house? Looks good, smells nice, people are helpful, and you think to yourself, man, must be nice to run your own store, huh? Maybe it's even a dream job. I mean, how hard can it be? In truth, it's pretty hard.
Hi. Did you meet the subject of today's interview?
Good to see you.
Pleasure to meet you.
Fashion writer Michelle Dalton Tyree welcomes us into her home in Los Angeles. Soft leather couches, cowhide rugs, cool art on the walls. Kind of looks like some of those stores. Not surprising when you find out. Michelle used to own one.
We carried Oscar de la Renta, Karl Lagerfeld, contemporary items like jeans, denim, t-shirts. We really mixed it up from low to high.
She'd wanted to do it forever.
Talk to me for a second about the business of setting up this dream you had. You had to have some seed capital to not only find the space and outfit and all that stuff, mm-hmm. but to go buy Oscar de la Renta to put on the racks mm-hmm. is not a cheap proposition.
No.
How not cheap is it?
How not cheap is it? Well, we carried the very basic, for example, Oscar de la Renta, like the opening minimum buy we had. And that opening minimum buy was at least about $30,000. Right there.
And that was only one buy of one brand. Because when it comes to retail, you got to change up the merchandise with the seasons, you know, and sometimes more often than that.
You know, the name of the game is this. The minute that box shows up at your store with new merchandise, you have a ticking time bomb.
The store did well for a while. And then there was the 2007 Hollywood writers' strike.
That was the first sign of trouble.
The Great Recession came next, and that was it. Michelle was out of business by the end of 2008.
There's
a phenomenon called the planning fallacy.
Craig Fox teaches decision making at UCLA.
We tend to underestimate how long it's going to take and how much investment it's going to take to complete our plans because we imagine the scenario of things going perfect. And we don't build some slack into our budgets for time and for money for the inevitable ways in which things can go wrong or where I need to make an unexpected additional investment to be viable.
Michael Deering totally gets that. Once upon a time, he wanted to sell shoes.
My dream that I had, that I worked on weekends and evenings whenever I could with my business partner, was to open a chain of retail stores.
But the economics of that dream didn't work out. His partner quit. Sales didn't come.
I was driving home from work, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. And I would cry almost every night driving home because this was going so poorly. And I got word that we had a shipment, and I knew I didn't have the cash to pay for those goods. And that's when I decided that I would liquidate.
Closing up shop hurts. That's the first thing Michael Deering will tell you. But in the long run, having failed kind of helps.
I can show you five or six examples in my current life where the knowledge I got from that experience is super, super helpful to me and to the entrepreneurs that I work with.
Michelle Dalton Tyree says the exact same thing.
You know, we learn to hustle, and that's invaluable. Sure, I mean, it's a financial bloodbath when you close it. I cannot lie about that. But there is absolutely a silver lining because you learn to be tough. And once you go through something like that, good luck killing you.
Ask any entrepreneur about starting their first business, and you'll hear a tale of maxed out credit cards and tense dealings with banks, frayed relationships with friends and family who've helped you out. Following your dreams can do some damage to your finances. And that's what we're talking about on Marketplace Money this weekend, a special partnership between Marketplace and the New York Times. Mind Games and Money, it's called. Check it out.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which the big banks get a big win. This afternoon, a federal judge in New York City dismissed a big chunk of the lawsuit against banks involved in the LIBOR scandal. The interest rate fixing, well, I don't know if I can call it a scam anymore, over in London from last year. Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, and others had been on the hook. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the markets were closed in observance of Good Friday. They are back on Monday. Don't forget the special edition of Marketplace Money this weekend in collaboration with the New York Times, Mind Games and Money. I get the guest host, which was kind of fun. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you on Monday. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.